Imagine for a second, you know, you're a creator. You have this incredible cinematic vision in your head, but to actually get it out into the world, you're locked into these incredibly expensive monthly subscriptions.
Right, the cloud paywalls.
Exactly. Every time you want to try an idea or just render a single scene, you're watching a meter tick down. You're essentially paying tolls on your own creativity.
Yeah, which is just exhausting for anyone trying to actually make art.
It really is.
Okay.
But then imagine you discover a back door, like a way to bypass the toll booth entirely and tap into unlimited, unconstrained rendering power right from the computer sitting on your desk.
I mean, it sounds like a pitch for a sci-fi novel,
Yeah.
right? But looking at the digital entertainment landscape in late 2026, this is just the new reality. The whole centralized cloud-based model of video generation is facing this massive structural disruption from open source alternatives.
And that is exactly what we are unpacking in this deep dive. We're looking at the local AI video revolution, and we're using a massive September 2026 guide from Tech and Game Media.
Yeah, the ultimate local AI video blueprint. That's a great read.
It really is. And the mission here is to figure out how you, the listener, can escape that cloud subscription trap and actually run a production-grade cinematic studio on your own hardware.
Which is suddenly very doable.
Okay, let's unpack this because we need to establish why so many people are suddenly desperate to get off the cloud in the first place.
Well, it basically comes down to an existential operational risk, you know,
Right.
for artists, freelance directors, even mid-sized studios.
Race.
Because for the past couple of years, the industry standard has been closed source platforms. You've got Runway Gen 3, OpenAI Sora
The
Pro.
big players.
Exactly. But relying on them means exposing yourself to, well, volatile fees, strict rate limits, generation caps.
Oh, and algorithmic filtration.
Yeah. Plus the priority queue throttling. I mean, you're just renting your tools, and the corporate landlord is constantly changing the rules.
You're entirely at their mercy. Like, if they decide to deprecate a feature you rely on, your workflow is just dead.
Exactly.
But the Tekken Game Blueprint highlights that this open source renaissance we're seeing in 2026 has fundamentally changed the power dynamic, right?
It really has. Because major research teams have brought these heavy-hitting production-grade AI models out of the data center. They've optimized them for consumer desktop GPUs.
Which is wild. But before we get into the how, we should probably talk about the what.
Right, the foundation models themselves. The ecosystem has matured way beyond those primitive, shaky video generators we were all playing with back in early 2024.
Oh man, I remember those. You'd try to generate a 5-second clip of a person walking down the street, and suddenly they'd sprout a third leg.
Right, or a car would just melt into the pavement.
Yeah, it was a novelty, not a real tool.
Exactly. But the current generation has basically solved those structural flaws. The first major heavyweight the guide breaks down is Minimax H3.
Also known in the community as highly open base, right?
Yeah, that's the one. It's a massive 33 billion parameter model.
33 billion. Wow.
Yeah, it's huge. And where it truly excels is in photorealistic human biometrics and dynamic cloth physics.
Okay.
And it maintains pristine 360-degree lighting consistency. So if you have a shot where a camera pans entirely around a subject, the shadows and highlights behave exactly as they should in reality.
Wait, really? So it actually understands object permanence. The character's face doesn't just morph because the camera angle changed?
It doesn't, and that is a massive technical leap.
That's credible.
It really is. And then you have Alibaba's WAN 2.1 suite, which the guide describes as a dual-tier system designed for a full production pipeline.
Dual tier, meaning they released two different versions.
Exactly. They released two distinct variants. The first is a lightweight 1.3 billion parameter version. It's ultra fast, like bordering on real time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, directors use that one for rapid prompt ideation, storyboarding, pre-vis work, just to quickly block out their scenes.
Which makes perfect sense. I mean, you
Perfect.
don't want to burn time generating a final pristine render if you're just trying to figure out camera placement.
Right, exactly. So once the blocking is set, then you switch to their flagship 14 billion parameter model.
A heavy hitter.
Yeah. That one utilizes this highly sophisticated 3D causal compression system. It produces just pristine 1080p footage with hyper-accurate fluid dynamics and atmospheric volumetric scattering.
Volumetric scattering, so like fog and light rays.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking about highly realistic fog or, you know, complex light rays filtering through a dirty window. It looks
But
amazing.
what if you don't care about ultra realism and you just want speed?
Well, if you're going for pure, unadulterated speed, the guide points to the third model. Lightricks LTX Video 2.5.
Right.
It's basically universally recognized as the fastest foundation model currently in existence.
How does it manage that?
It uses an architecture called an asymmetric spatial temporal diffusion transformer.
Okay, that is a mouthful.
It is.
Yeah.
But the net result is a 300% inference speed up over older designs.
300%.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is the underlying architectural shift connecting all three of these models.
Oh, please, lay it on me.
They have universally abandoned the legacy 2D UNet backbones that powered older image and video generators.
Right.
They've all migrated to diffusion transformers, or DDIT for short. In the old UNet days, AI treated video as a sequential chain of flat 2D images. It analyzed frame one and then basically tried to guess what frame two should look like.
So it's basically like trying to paint a flipbook page by page while blindfolded. Like, by the time you get to page 10, you've completely forgotten what page one looked like.
Yes, yeah. That is exactly what was happening.
But these new 4D DDIT models are more like building a tiny, mathematically perfect movie set inside your computer.
Right.
So when you introduce a light source or a shadow or gravity, the model calculates it for the entire scene all at once. Nothing melts because the physics are computed holistically.
That captures the mechanism perfectly.
Mm.
The model processes the video as a unified 4D spatiotemporal volume.
Okay, 4D meaning time is the fourth dimension there.
Exactly. The entire continuous manifold of the scene, how light propagates, specular reflections off wet surfaces, gravitational trajectories of falling objects, it's all calculated as a single interrelated volume rather than a series of disconnected pictures.
Okay, but this brings up a glaring mechanical problem.
Oh.
Yeah. If Minimax H3 has 33 billion parameters, and it takes massive supercomputer clusters just to train it.
Yeah.
How on earth are people running this on a standard computer?
Right.
Because we aren't talking about enterprise server racks here. The files themselves must be gargantuan.
Well, in their raw state, they are. A standard 16-bit floating point checkpoint for a model like Minimax might be 30 gigabytes or more.
Which most graphics cards cannot hold.
Exactly. And this is where the magic software engineering comes into play. The guide outlines an orchestrated stack of software optimizations that shrink these giants down. And the foundation of that stack is 4-bit GGUF quantization.
Right, quantization. Yeah. You all know that's how we compress these models to make them fit. But the guide mentions a specific format, right? Q4KMM.
Yes, specifically Q4KM. It takes a massive 30 gigabyte model and compresses it down to sleek 5 to 8 gigabyte files by reducing 16-bit floating points to 4-bit.
But wait, if you're compressing the data that heavily, it's like taking a massive encyclopedia and flawlessly summarizing it into a pocket guide.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
How are we not seeing massive artifacting and visual degradation when you cut 90% of the data?
Because the community researchers have refined these quantization algorithms to be incredibly selective.
What do you mean?
Well, at its core, an AI model is just a database of numbers, right? GGUF quantization mathematically truncates those high-precision 16-bit numbers down into 4-bit representations. But it doesn't do it uniformly.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the algorithm is smart enough to identify the critical visual components, the parts of the neural network responsible for crisp textures and fine details, and it leaves those at a higher precision.
So it's only aggressively compressing the deeper, more abstract layers of the network.
Exactly. The result is that 90% reduction in memory footprint with virtually no perceptual loss in quality.
So it was throwing away the mathematical fluff, but keeping the core structural data intact. That's brilliant.
It really is.
So that gets the model onto the hard drive. But what about the processing speed? Because the guide mentions something called T-cache time step embedding aware cache and claims it gives an average 1.82x inference speed up.
Right.
It's almost doubling the generation speed. How does it do that?
It does that by eliminating redundant mathematical calculations. When a diffusion model generates a video, it starts with pure static noise and iteratively removes that noise over a series of steps, usually like 30 to 50 steps.
Right.
But during the middle of that denoising process, the actual visual changes between one step and the next become minuscule.
Hold on, though. If it's skipping the math to save time, doesn't the video quality take a hit? Like, how does the AI know it's safe to just skip a rendering step?
Because it's constantly measuring the variance. T-cache acts as an intelligent tracking engine. It analyzes the visual difference between the current step and the previous one.
Okay.
And if it looks at the map and determines that the variance falls below a specific threshold, meaning nothing much is changing in the frame right now, it skips the computationally expensive self-attention calculation entirely.
Oh. It simply reuses the data from the previous step and moves on.
Exactly.
So it's literally like a smart GPS. If it sees a massive traffic jam ahead on your daily commute, it doesn't just sit there burning fuel. It recalculates a shortcut that gets you to the exact same destination, but you completely skip the bottleneck.
That is exactly the right way to visualize it. You slash the generation time by roughly 50% without introducing any temporal flicker or texture blurring, just because it only skips the steps that didn't matter anyway.
That is so smart.
And the final piece of this software optimization trio is Sage Attention.
Okay, what does that one do?
This specific tool targets the memory spikes that typically crash consumer GPUs during generation. The guide notes it slashes the attention memory footprint by an additional 50%.
Wow, 50%.
Yeah, and it does it using fused hardware-accelerated kernels.
Wait, back up. Fused hardware-accelerated kernels. You completely lost me there. What is actually happening physically inside the GPU when it does that?
Right, sorry. So standard attention mechanisms are highly inefficient with memory. To understand a scene, the AI has to calculate the relationship of every single pixel to every other pixel.
Which sounds like a lot of math.
It is. Traditionally, the GPU calculates a chunk of that math, writes the temporary result to its memory, reads it back, calculates the next chunk, and so on. All that reading and writing creates massive memory bloat.
Yeah, so it's a bottleneck.
Exactly. What Sage Attention does is it fuses those operations. It replaces those memory-heavy allocation matrices with hardware-accelerated kernels. It basically groups the math operations directly on the hardware level, specifically on NVIDIA Tensor Cores. So the GPU calculates the entire sequence in one go without having to constantly store and retrieve temporary data, with zero loss in precision.
Oh, I see. It's doing all the math in its head rather than constantly writing it down on scratch paper?
Yes.
Yeah. So you compress the file size with GGUF, you skip redundant calculations with Tcache, and you optimize the physical memory flow with Sage Attention. That perfectly explains the software sorcery.
It's a pretty elegant stack.
It is. But magic software still needs a physical brain to run it.
Yeah.
With all these optimizations, are we still talking about incredibly high-end gaming rigs here?
Not necessarily, no. The guide breaks down the actual physical gear you'd need into distinct, accessible tiers. You really don't need a $10,000 server.
Okay, let's hear the tiers.
Let's start with tier one, the budget, low memory baseline. We are talking about common 6 gigabyte to 8 gigabyte VRAM graphics cards, things like the RTX 2060 or the RTX 3060.
Wait, really? Those are incredibly standard mass market cards. A lot of people have those sitting in their home offices right now.
Exactly. And the empirical data in the blueprint shows a 74.6% success rate in executing these quantized foundation models on those exact cards.
That's amazing.
Yeah, you can reliably synthesize 480p and 576p cinematic sequences. However, there is a strict non-negotiable rule for this budget tier.
Oh, what's the catch?
You absolutely must have at least 32 gigabytes of high-speed system RAM.
Okay, but if a quantized model is, say, 8 gigabytes, and the graphics card only has 6 gigabytes of VRAM, it physically can't hold the model. Why doesn't it just crash out of memory? How does having 32 gigs of system RAM solve a GPU bottleneck?
Right, it does it through a mechanism called sequential block offloading.
Which means?
A sophisticated node-based software like CompUI acts as a traffic controller. It stores the massive idle parts of the AI model in your abundant 32 gigabyte system RAM. Then it rapidly pages only the specific block of data it needs into the GPU's smaller VRAM for a fraction of a millisecond.
Oh, wow.
It processes it and then swaps it out for the next block. It's moving data from system RAM to GPU VRAM dynamically.
So it's juggling the data back and forth across the motherboard so fast that the graphics card never even realizes it's processing something larger than itself.
Exactly. That juggling act is what keeps the budget cards alive in this space. Mm. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you have tier three, the enterprise workstations.
The big guns.
Yeah. These feature flagship cards with 24 gigabytes of VRAM or more. We're talking the legendary RTX 3090, the 4090, or the newer 5090.
Right.
In this tier, there is no juggling. The models execute in complete, uncompromised precision entirely inside the dedicated VRAM.
No offloading required.
None. You get continuous high-throughput 1080p generation, real-time upscaling to 4K, and you can even set up automated overnight rendering queues.
The guide points out a really interesting detail here, though, about why older flagship cards like a used RTX 3090 are vastly superior to newer budget cards for AI, even if the newer cards are better for gaming.
Right. It comes down to the memory bus width and the PCIe bus bottleneck.
Can you explain that? Because it sounds super technical.
Sure. The PCI bus is basically the physical bridge connecting your graphics card to the rest of the computer. When the GPU is reading billions of parameters per time step, the width of the memory bus, the highway inside the GPU itself, dictates everything.
Okay, I'm following.
An entry-level card might have a narrow 128-bit memory bus, but an enthusiast card, like the RTX 3090, has a massive 384-bit bus.
So it's a much wider highway.
Exponentially wider. It transfers data so much faster, exceeding 1 terabyte per second. When you were processing those 4D spatiotemporal volumes we talked about, that highway width directly dictates your rendering speed.
That makes a lot of sense. I did notice something weird in the guide about Macs, though. Usually, Apple gets completely left out of the hardcore AI rendering or gaming GPU conversations, but here they actually have a structural advantage.
A very significant one, actually, specifically regarding Apple Silicon, the M2 and M3 Max chips.
Right.
Traditional PCs suffer from that PCIe bottleneck we just discussed. Data has to travel across a physical bridge between the system RAM and the GPU VRAM. But Apple's architecture uses unified memory architecture.
Oh.
The CPU and the GPU share the exact same massive pool of RAM, which can be configured up to 192 gigabytes.
So there is no bridge. The GPU just reaches over and grabs the data in.
Exactly. It bypasses the PCIe bottleneck entirely. You can load a massive 33 billion parameter model completely into memory all at once without any GGUF quantization if you want to.
That's wild.
It makes high-end Macs incredible whisper-quiet powerhouse rendering suites for these specific AI workflows.
Okay, so the hardware pathways are clear. But why go through all this effort? Why hunt down a used RTX 3090 on the secondary market, upgrade your system RAM, and learn how to wire together comfy UI node graphs?
Right, the learning curve.
Exactly. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Well,
let's talk money.
Yeah.
Because the financial math of the cloud is a total trap, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, the financial telemetry provided in the guide is eye-opening. The math completely falls apart for cloud. If you operate a small studio or you're a freelance commercial director relying on the cloud, a standard corporate setup, say a Runway Gen 3 unlimited subscription paired with a Sora Pro tier, will cost you an exorbitant amount.
We're talking, what, $1,000?
More. A staggering $11,140 to $2,400 per year just for a single seat.
Over a two-year production cycle, you are burning nearly $5,000. And at the end of those 2 years, you own zero equity. You have no hardware assets. The minute your credit card expires, your studio literally ceases to exist.
Exactly. Now contrast that operating expense with a local capital investment.
Right.
Procuring a pristine secondary market RTX 3090 with 24 gigabytes of VRAM costs roughly, you know, $650 to $750.
Okay.
You add in 64 gigabytes of RAM and a high-speed 2 terabyte Gen 4 NVMe solid-state drive, and your total initial hardware capital investment is roughly $1,050.
So you spend $1,050 once versus bleeding out up to $2,400 every single year. The return on investment there is incredibly aggressive.
It is. The guide reveals that for an active commercial studio, this capital expenditure reaches the full break-even point in under 6.5 months.
Wow.
Specifically, it's between 4.2 to 6.8 months. And beyond that threshold, the marginal cost to render a 1080p video drops to effectively zero. Or, to be hyper-precise, about 0.01 cents in household electricity per render.
14-tenths of a cent in electricity per shot. That fundamentally changes how a studio can operate. You've transformed a consumable expense into an income-generating capital asset.
Exactly.
Plus, that local hardware retains about 50 to 60% of its salvage value. If you decide to sell the workstation in 2 years, you recoup a massive chunk of your initial output. And in the meantime, it doubles as a 4K editing rig or just a high-end gaming PC.
From an accounting and business sustainability standpoint, the migration from centralized cloud SaaS to local workstations isn't just like a fun hobbyist project anymore.
No, it's a financial imperative for survival in this industry.
Absolutely. But you know, the benefits extend far beyond just the economics. We really have to look at what this unlocks creatively.
Oh, for sure. It's not just the money. The cloud platforms literally dictate what you can and can't make. If we are talking about creative sovereignty, running these models locally unlocks capabilities that cloud APIs flat out forbid or structurally just cannot offer.
Right. Complete privacy and zero censorship. That's a crucial point for professional environments.
Tell me more about that.
Commercial cloud platforms operate behind very opaque safety layers and corporate heuristics. They actively monitor, filter, and sometimes they even silently overwrite your prompts to align with their internal policies.
Yeah, the invisible hand. Just to be clear for our listeners, we're not taking a stance on whether corporate safety layers are inherently good or bad, but looking at this impartially. Whether a studio is producing a gritty action sequence, an explosive sci-fi thriller, or simply trying to protect highly confidential corporate screenplays from being scraped for cloud data mining local sovereignty is the only viable solution.
Exactly. It leaves the control entirely in the artist's hands. There are no arbitrary content policy violation pop-ups on your own hard drive. You hold the keys to your own data.
Which is so important. But the technical control you get is just as vital for actual filmmaking. On cloud platforms, if you try to make a short film, the main character is going to subtly mutate in every single shot. The cheekbones change, the jacket changes color.
Oh, the shape-shifting problem.
Yes. It is nearly impossible to tell a consistent narrative when your actor is constantly mutating between shots.
That's because on the cloud, you don't have access to the deep, latent conditioning vectors of the model. You can only guide it with text.
Right.
But locally, inside a comfy UI node graph, a creator can train a lightweight LoRA.
That's a low-rank adaptation checkpoint, right?
Yes. You can train a LoRA specifically on a single actor's face or even a proprietary corporate brand identity. And the guide notes this training process takes just 20 to 45 minutes on a single RTX 3090.
That is so fast.
It is. You patch that small adapter directly into the foundation video model, guaranteeing immutable identity preservation across dozens of different shots, camera angles, and lighting setups.
And you aren't just limited to one adapter. The guide details this multi-conditioning aspect, calling it multi-LoRA stacking.
Oh, yeah. This is where it gets crazy.
I know. I nerded out over this part. Because you're rendering locally, a director can simultaneously combine a character identity LoRA to keep the actor's face locked, a cinematic lighting LoRA to add authentic Kodak 35mm film grain, and a camera motion LoRA to force the AI to execute a dynamic FTV drone dive simultaneously.
Right. You are stacking these discrete instructions together on a shot-by-shot basis. It is a level of surgical, granular artistic control that is just completely unavailable on closed platforms.
You are successfully isolating the character's appearance from the background environment and the camera dynamics.
You really are. And, you know, this raises an important question regarding the trajectory of technology as a whole.
It mirrors what happened to traditional CGI, doesn't it?
It does perfectly. The history of computer graphics demonstrates a pretty consistent law. If you look at the early 2000s, complex CGI rendering required massive, multi-million-dollar supercomputer render farms in Hollywood, right?
Right, rooms full of massive servers humming away.
Exactly. But eventually, that capability migrated directly to consumer desktop silicon with the advent of real-time ray tracing. We are witnessing that exact same historical migration right now with generative AI.
The power is moving from the centralized data center to the sovereign desktop workstation.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? The 2026 local AI video revolution proves that absolute artistic sovereignty isn't a future promise. It is accessible right now, today, on consumer hardware.
It really is.
Between GGUF quantization shrinking these 33 billion parameter giants down, T-Cache dramatically accelerating the generation speeds, and an initial hardware investment of around $1,000, you literally have the blueprint to build a production-grade film studio on your desk.
You can escape the cloud paywalls entirely and take control of your own tools. It truly democratizes the medium.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I want to leave you with a final thought that extends beyond the immediate hardware and software pipelines we've discussed today.
Okay, let's hear it.
If the marginal cost of rendering a photorealistic, complex narrative video is effectively zero, and any individual can generate infinite realities overnight in their basement workstation, how will society and culture fundamentally reevaluate the inherent value of video? Like, what is the concept of truth in video media over the coming years?
Wow. If a video costs nothing to make,
yeah,
and anyone can make it, what is it actually worth? And can we ever trust what we're seeing on a screen again?
Right. It's a massive paradigm shift.
It is definitely something to chew on. Well, we hope this deep dive gave you the blueprint you need to take control of your creative tools and maybe unlock that secret back door to unlimited power for yourself. Keep questioning, keep exploring, and we'll catch you on the next one.